Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. The dispossession of Palestinians from their homes in the East Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah by Israeli settlers, many from Brooklyn, is once again in the news. The struggle to save Sheikh Jarrah for Palestinians is a long struggle. In fact, in 2008, while on a delegation to Palestine, we visited Sheikh Jarrah during one of the earliest settler takeovers of a Palestinian dwelling in the complex. Israeli settlers had literally occupied a portion of a Palestinian home and lived there simultaneously in the house while the original owners were still living there. This is exactly what is still happening today, as settlers are attempting to seize the entire development. Sheikh Jarrah was established by the Jordanian government in 1950 to provide homes for Palestinians driven off their land as a result of the Israeli military invasions of 1948 and 1967. Yet, the occupying Jews are claiming they are recovering their land, which was stolen by Palestinians. The claim is outrageous. Deeds to the land owned by Palestinians go all the way back to the Ottoman Empire. Here to discuss the current situation in Sheikh Jarrah are Asil El Bajeh, legal researcher and advocacy officer at Al Haq, and author and journalist Budar Hassan. The conversation is moderated by Laura Friedman, executive director of the Foundation for Middle East Peace.
So, good morning and welcome. I'm Laura Friedman. I'm the president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Thank you for joining us today for our webinar entitled Jerusalem on the Verge, Dispossession and Violence in Sheikh Jarrah. So the context for today's webinar is what we're seeing happening today on the ground in East Jerusalem, where the struggle in Sheikh Jarrah is again on center stage. And once again, Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah are facing imminent evictions approved by Israeli courts. And once again, Palestinians of Sheikh Jarrah are resisting efforts to remove them from their longtime homes. And they are once again being met with violence and repression from Israeli authorities and Israeli settlers. So to discuss this struggle and the dynamics in Jerusalem and how both are part of the broader struggle against escalating Israeli policies of Palestinian dispossession in Jerusalem and beyond, I am very happy and honored, really, to be joined by two experts, and you can find their full bios on the Foundation for Middle East Peace's website. I'll go through them very briefly here. First, we have Asil El Bajeh. Asil is a legal researcher and advocacy officer at Al Haq, which is the well-known Palestinian human rights organization. Asil was awarded the Ireland Palestine Scholarship Program to study at the Irish Center for Human Rights at National University of Ireland, Galway, completing her LLM in International Human Rights Law in 2020. Second, we have Budar Hassan, who is a Palestinian writer, a journalist, and a legal researcher based in Jerusalem. Her work has appeared in outlets like Al Jazeera, Middle East Eye, Huffington Post, and Mada Masr, among others. So with that, we're going to just dive right in. We're going to start off with the sort of breaking news. And Asil, I want to start with you. Today, it was a big day, in theory, for the four families in Sheikh Jarrah who are facing dispossession. With a legal date. This was a legal date for them when they had to do something. So can you fill us in on what that was about and if anything happened? And just sort of as background, the eviction of these four families was scheduled actually for May 2nd, but that was delayed by a court. And today was a date when it was one of the trigger dates for what happens next. So Asil, if you could jump in first with this background. Thank you.
Thank you, Lara. As you said, yes, today is, but every day is an important date for the families of Sheikh Jarrah. But specifically, as you said, the families, four families consisting of 30 Palestinians in East Jerusalem were ordered to leave their homes by Jerusalem District Court by 2nd of May, which was a couple of days ago. And they appealed this order to the Supreme Israeli Supreme Court. And basically at the session a couple of days ago, the judge gave the families a political, I would say this is a political offer for them to accept that the settler organization has rights, ownership rights to the lands of Sheikh Jarrah, and so to be awarded or afforded a protected tenancy status and to pay rent for the settler organization. Now, immediately after, the judge gave them a period of 2 to 3 days to decide with the settler organization. Now, immediately after this political offer, the families issued their positions that they reject such a political offer, since we will talk more in detail about the specifics of the case of Sheikh Jarrah, but they rejected the offer. And as such, today the decision was delivered by the families to the Supreme Court, and the families again postponed the hearing till the 10th of May in a couple of days. But I would like to mention here, like, some important stuff about this Israeli court sessions is that, first of all, these courts apply Israeli domestic law unlawfully. Which is unlawfully transferred to the occupied East Jerusalem, and that these laws themselves are also discriminatory in their nature. These are part of Israel's apartheid regime. And in East Jerusalem, these laws are specifically used to dispossess and displace Palestinians furthermore. So this is in terms of the laws that we're talking about that the courts are imposing. But also the courts themselves are very much discriminatory and untransparent, given the experience of the Sheikh Jarrah families, but also with all Jerusalemites who have been experiencing a discriminatory treatment by these courts. And I would like to say that when these families, Sheikh Jarrah families, resort to the Israeli courts, they're not acknowledging or trusting these courts, but rather they are trying to exhaust all the means that they have in order to, at this time, just to save time, even to have some time for them to have the right fulfilled. And in some cases, also the courts have like evictions have happened while the courts were cases were pending. Maybe Budur has firsthand experience working since she has been working in East Jerusalem longer than that. With the Shamasna family in 2017, the family was evicted while still an appeal was pending in East Jerusalem. This is also in Sheikh Jarrah and another part of the neighborhood. So I think it's important to keep all these things in mind while we're talking about the Israeli courts in occupied East Jerusalem.
Thanks, Asil. And just, I mean, maybe we can talk about this more in the rest of the conversation somewhere, but I think for people, I think my colleagues put something into the chat about this, so you can read about the legislation. But I mean, fundamentally, the laws that are being applied were written to dispossess Palestinians. I mean, they're written to enable Israeli Jews to reclaim land, a right of return to lands from pre-48 or pre-67. And they are written to prevent Palestinian claims being made. So, I mean, there's that fundamental structural piece of it that works that way. I'd love if one of you could talk more about that as we go on. Badur, over to you. So, and Asil just referred to this. You know, what's happening this week is not the only urgent case in Sheikh Jarrah. Can you explain what is happening with the additional cases of dispossession that are looming? And here, I mean, I'm thinking about the seven families that are facing August eviction, I believe it is. Talk about the larger battle unfolding, which isn't a new battle, it's been going on for decades, but what's unfolding today between Palestinians and the settlers and the Israeli state and the courts?
As Asil said, we are talking about four families that were supposed to be, I will say, displaced on the 2nd of May. In addition to these four families, an additional three families are also facing displacement orders for August. Because in February 2021, when the Israeli District Court approved the decision of the Magistrate Court to displace all these families, we had two cases, or we have two groups of cases almost just separated by a couple of weeks. In both cases, the District Court upheld the decision previously issued by the magistrate courts. So, and in many cases, we're talking about very similar cases in nature. We're talking about refugee families who've been living in Sheikh Jarrah since 1956 and who've been embroiled in a decades-long legal battle and who've been hovering under this threat of displacement for decades. In cases, you have children who've lived their entire lives with this weapon of displacement just directed at their chests, really, and have known nothing but court dates, and when the court is expected to displace us. So this is the wider context. So when we're talking about these specific four families that will be displaced soon, and the additional three families. And in addition, we have the Sabah family, whose case is a little bit different. So it's not being heard along with these seven families, but they're also part of the case. So we're talking about more than 70 people, including many children who are facing the threat of displacement as we speak. And unlike previous cases when the Israeli settler organization, specifically Nahlat Shim'on, which is registered in the United States and received exemptions from paying taxes, as a supposedly charitable organization, because it's registered as a charitable organization in the United States. So when Nahlat Shim'on comes and displaces families, they usually kind of have a typical pattern of displacing one family at a time. And since 2009, with the exception of the Chamasni case, which happened in 2017, which is a bit different because Chamasnis were not refugee families, and they were in a different part of Sheikh Jarrah, not in the Kerem el-Jaouni area. All the cases we're talking about, they're all in the Kerem el-Jaouni area. But apart from the Chamasni case, we've seen no displacement since 2009. And it was believed that partly due to political pressure, also largely due to the mobilization by residents, by Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah. But now the difference is that the settler organization, Nahlat Shim'on, is not really waiting anymore. They really want to do this displacement by droves. And this is one major difference between what we're seeing now and what we've seen years before, that we're talking about a huge number of families, which means that the whole dynamics is changing, because we're not just talking about an individual family. We're talking literally about entire families, dozens of residents, entire lives being torn apart from where they have lived for decades.
Thank you. And before we go sort of more into the broader story, I want to continue focusing on where things are today. And Badur, I want to stick with you here. A lot of us, I'm sitting here in Washington, D.C. I know around the world, a lot of us are sort of glued to, you know, Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, seeing what's happening on the ground. I mean, this is, you know, for all the negatives of social media, this is a positive. We're seeing it. Can you talk about, I know you are spending a lot of time in Sheikh Jarrah. I know you were there. I think you're there almost every night. Can you talk about what these nightly protests are? You know, these are being led by Palestinians. The families in Sheikh Jarrah, I know, are close, are, from what I see on social media, deeply involved in leading this. And can you talk about that role that they're playing and the retaliation that you're seeing on the ground from Israeli authorities?
Since the start of Ramadan, the Muslim month of fasting, and basically, which means 2 weeks into April, there have been daily, nightly clashes, let's say, between Palestinian youth, specifically in Damascus Gate, and protest at Israeli measures meant of blocking people from arriving at the steps of Damascus Gate. And the momentum that these protests have created in Damascus Gate didn't just stay there. We all the youngsters who go to the protests in Damascus Gate, many of whom had no prior political involvement or direct political involvement, in the sense that they didn't go to protests. Because when we talk about politics, politics really infiltrates every single aspect of Palestinian lives. So we don't really have the luxury not to be political in the broader sense of the word. So due to the calls made by families in Sheikh Jarrah and the massive effort they have played both locally in mobilizing and in inviting people and calling on people, staging even concerts in Sheikh Jarrah, by taking advantage of the fact that, unlike in other months, Jerusalem usually sleeps early, but in Ramadan it changes. So people stay up for late. It's a very public month. Many things, many activities are held after 8, 9 p.m. So the families in Sheikh Jarrah very cleverly took advantage of this fact and started calling on people to join them, to watch shows, to as a statement, political statement, that we're staying here. In retaliation fest, you'd hear settlers starting play loud music, very annoying music from their speakers, from the houses that they have occupied, particularly the house of Nabil al-Kurd. So this is one of the centers in which they play their very loud and very annoying music in order to hijack any attempt of Palestinians to gather, to protest, to do even the most civic activity, which is just sitting there having their iftar, which is the meal of breaking the fast together publicly in Sheikh Jarrah. And especially in the last week, this has developed. So instead of just holding these evening gatherings, the momentum, as I said, went, morphed from these just daily evening protests in Damascus Gate and reached Sheikh Jarrah, particularly because there have been attempts to block Palestinian youth from reaching Damascus Gate. So it's instead of just going back to their homes, people started joining in and protesting. In addition, we've seen also, and this is one of the most really lively, inspiring things about the protests, that you don't just have Palestinians from Jerusalem coming and Palestinians from neighboring villages in Jerusalem, like Isawiyye, like Shafat, like Wadi al-Jouz. You also have Palestinians from Haifa, from all over historic Palestine, from Haifa, from Umm al-Fahim, from Taibe, which is, these are areas in northern, some in southern or northern historic Palestine, coming, some of whom just using public transport and coming, many university students, college students, who are coming and joining. And you also have people, and the really beautiful thing is how this translates into the chanting of people. So you have chants that are symbolic to some area of Palestine being repeated in Sheikh Jarrah. You have all the symbolic and iconic chant slogans, the famous songs of that are sung, some of them that were adapted to the case of Sheikh Jarrah. And this is how Palestinians started resisting these attempts, especially there was a massive protest on Saturday, which gathered many Palestinians from all over historic Palestine came. And after that, it continued every night despite repression. And when we talk about repression by Israel, we talk about use of sound grenades by the Israeli border police. Obviously, the use of the skunk truck, which is the foul smell distilled water. Usually, it was first used in Damascus Gate, and they transferred this truck that throws fire the skunk water. They spray the homes with skunk. They spray protesters with skunk. And on certain occasions, they also even use tear gas. So these are the ways, and obviously with the horses, and whenever you start standing, singing, and even raising the Palestinian flag, because in Jerusalem, the very act of raising the Palestinian flag is perceived by Israeli occupation police as a threat to their very fake sovereignty over this area. So whenever the Palestinian flag is raised, you will have the hordes of Israeli soldiers attacking whoever who's raising the flag, brutally beating protesters. And we've seen some of the scenes where Palestinian protesters, unarmed protesters, were beaten brutally, were harassed, were detained. So this is the way it has been. And I think that it will continue today also after iftar. We will be gathering in Sheikh Jarrah and also every day just to carry on, to keep this momentum going, and to say that the case of Sheikh Jarrah is not just the case of one neighborhood. It's not even the case of one city, which is Jerusalem. It's a Palestinian case because it's a paradigmatic of the entire Palestinian struggle for liberation and decolonization.
Thank you. Asil, can you add on to that a little bit in terms of what you think these protests can accomplish, what the goals of the protests are, both in a limited sense on Sheikh Jarrah and more broadly? And maybe, I don't want to skip ahead too far, but, you know, how you see this, you know, there have been moments in history, including one not that long ago, the grassroots protest against the magnetometers on the Haram al-Sharif, where you've actually seen real impact when there's been grassroots, or even taking down the barriers at Damascus Gate. Is this something where that kind of victory might be replicated, or is it somehow a different test?
I think what Budur said in regards to how these protests are not only about Sheikh Jarrah and not only about Jerusalem, they represent the anger by the Palestinian youth who have been suppressed and denied from the right to expression and the right to exercise the right self-determination. So now we are seeing a great mobilization, particularly by Palestinian youth. And as Budur also said, we're seeing Palestinians from what is now considered Israel also joining these protests. And in this, I would say that the goal of the message of these protests is, first of all, to stop the evictions themselves, but overall to protest what Israel has always been doing, which is in Jerusalem specifically to empty the city from its Palestinian residents and to ensure, as they publicly state shamelessly, that they want to ensure the demographic composition of the city is in favor of Israeli Jewish domination. So the various, like forced eviction and Sheikh Jarrah is just one example, because every single neighborhood of Jerusalem is under the threat of displacement and dispossession under various pretexts, illegal, because Israel does practice dispossession and displacement under its rule of law. And rule of law here does not equal justice. The Israeli discriminatory laws are designed, as we said, to displace and dispossess Palestinians. And so these protests are a sign and a message in order to stop all these settler colonial policies in East Jerusalem, but also elsewhere, because we've seen in the past couple of months also protests in Umm al-Fahm, in the Gaza Strip, under various pretexts and in different forms in historic Palestine, these policies to displace Palestinians and to have in historic Palestine minimum a number of Palestinians as possible are taking various forms. But the Palestinian youth have the same message, which is to ensure that their land remain with them and that they are liberated from the Israeli colonization.
I would like to add one thing regarding the efficacy of these protests. I like the fact that you brought up the successful sit-in that took place in 2017 against the installation of the metal detectors in Al-Haram al-Sharif. And really, it's very similar. It really, all the time, it's when we saw the way the youth in Damascus Gate removed the barriers and the barricades, it really was brought back the memories of those days in 2017 when the youth also managed to march through the gates and open through Bab Hutta Gate and in their thousands, even carrying some martyrs' parents on their shoulders. And really that moment, although the makeup of the protesters was a bit different in 2017 to what it was in the Damascus Gate protests, but it really was reminiscent. It was also reminiscent in 2014 in the protests that Jerusalem saw after the brutal killing of Muhammad Abu Khdeir in Shu'afat. We've seen also some protests in October 2015. One thread that unifies these protest movements, these many of which were really spontaneous, largely leaderless, is that they are about reclaiming the public space. And in Jerusalem, it's a big thing because you don't really, one of the efforts that have been really strengthened by Israel is the way to control, to dominate the public space and to just prevent Palestinians from expressing themselves politically, publicly, artistically in the public space. So it's always been a battle over the public space, over who dominates the public space, who controls it, because it also applies to who controls the narrative and whose voices are heard. So, and in a sense, the protests in Sheikh Jarrah is an extension. Now, we're not naive to think that just couple of hundreds protesting might prevent Israel from carrying on its displacement plan. We know that we know the power and the might of the Israeli army, the Israeli police, in terms of sheer brute force. And we know that it's absolutely asymmetric because the most we can, use is, in addition to our voices, is that for the youth to throw stones or bottles and that's it really. So it's not even symmetric in this sense. But the really important thing is that it's emboldening more and more people to join. And it's making this case a public case. So it's absolutely putting pressure. And also, in a sense, it's also exposing the fragility of the Israeli army, because despite its sheer brute force and its power, when you see that these soldiers are scared of a flag, and when you see that the very fact that we're standing there and singing is just enough to scare them and to bring all these special unit forces and border police and to use all these weapons, it also gives us more, it's hard to say, but it inspires even more courage among people, because if you're so fragile, if you're so weak, then you can't really intimidate us despite all that you've done. But we definitely know that just these protests are not enough. They need to be joined and backed up by genuine pressure that yields, not just lip service, that supports these protests. But we also simultaneously realize that nothing will be changed and no displacement will be prevented unless these protests continue and manage to gather steam onward.
Thank you. That's a very powerful statement, I think, and I'm inspired hearing you say it. I want to take a step back and go into the context a little bit. And Bedour, I want to stay with you for a moment. Can we talk about, assuming that everyone who's on this call is seeing what's happening in the news, I don't assume that everyone knows the basics of Sheikh Jarrah and the people that live there, particularly the people who are under pressure now to be evicted. So can you talk about the population of Sheikh Jarrah? Who lives there? How long have they lived there? How did they get there? And of course, Sheikh Jarrah was part of the area of East Jerusalem that was annexed by Israel illegally in 1967. So maybe talk a little bit about what that meant for Palestinians who were already living in Sheikh Jarrah.
So I will probably start from one story, but I think it's her story is the story that is common to so many families in Sheikh Jarrah. She is Rifqa al-Kurd. She passed away last year at the age of over 100 years old. She was a buoyant, very passionate young woman in 1948, when in April, so in days like these, she and her family were displaced from the coastal city of Haifa. And Rifqa al-Kurd moved to Jerusalem first. And in 1956, like the other 28 families, she became obviously a refugee, like internally displaced. But she was, unlike other families who were displaced and remained in historic Palestine, in the areas occupied by Israel and then turned and called Israel, she moved to Jerusalem, which was then to East Jerusalem, which was then under the Jordanian control. So in 1956, UNRWA, the United Nations Refugee Organization for Work, the Agency for Work and Refugees, and the Jordanian government, they leased this piece of land. And they agreed, the refugee families agreed to give up their refugee card in exchange of housing. And this has to do also with the terrible housing crisis that afflicted many Palestinian refugees and many, and it was a very difficult decision to make. And it's not an easy when a refugee is asked about to make this decision between whether to stay a refugee or to accept a land and housing, it's very easy to put, I mean, I've heard it from many people that they regret that their parents had taken their decision. So obviously it's impossible to put yourself in their shoes. They had so many things to take into account. But then these families decided that it's better to live stably and to have a house of your own rather than just stay and live in a refugee camp for the entirety of their lives. So these families, these 28 families, agreed to exchange their refugee status for housing. According to the articles of the agreement between Jordan, the UNRWA, and the families, these families were supposed to get ownership over the land and over the houses after 3 years from constructing and building these houses. This never materialized. Obviously, in 1967, Israel completed its occupation of all of Jerusalem. So this part, all of Jerusalem now is under Israeli control and occupation and subsequent annexation also, including these refugee families that lived in Sheikh Jarrah. Immediately after the occupation in 1967, one of the first homes that were occupied was the Shanti family home, because they were outside of Palestine at the time. So they declared it as abandoned property. Abandoned means that they prevented people from returning to this home and took over it to pave the way for a series of displacement. Starting from the early 1970s, Israel decided that this area, the claim was that the land on which these houses were built, that in the end of the 19th century, they were sold to Jewish families living there. This is one big contested issue regarding ownership. And the issue of ownership, legally speaking, I don't want to embroil you in the sophisticated legal technicalities, but the issue of ownership has not been sealed in the court. So there has not been a decision. What we know is that the responsible for absentee property registered the land in Sheikh Jarrah in the name of settler organizations, based on what we Palestinians argue, based on false documents that have not proven. And in fact, the families have brought documents from Istanbul, from Turkey, that show that some of these documents that the settlers brought are not are forged documents. But it's a massive issue. And I think one of the successes, in a sense, of the settlers was to transform this issue from a struggle over land to merely bureaucratic property, real estate issue, when it's not. The real reason that these settler organizations led by Nahlat Shimon right now want to take advantage and want to control these homes in Sheikh Jarrah is the strategic position of Sheikh Jarrah. It's the gateway. It's in the north of the old city, it's north to the old city. It's a very strategic area. And it's also, it's kind of one of the, it connects east to west as well. So it's a strategic, just like, for example, Silwan, it's a very strategic area because it's very close to Al-Aqsa Mosque. So the strategic place of Sheikh Jarrah is the reason that's pushing settlers to try and dominate it. And then obviously you can always use whatever pretext that the law allows you to use in order to take advantage of the loopholes that you have in order to control these houses and this land. And since the 1970s, and specifically since the early 1980s, because some families, not knowing the Israeli law and tricked by one Israeli lawyer, because at the time Palestinian lawyers were not allowed, were on strike, and they didn't recognize the legitimacy of the Israeli court, so they didn't represent Palestinian families. So one of the Israeli lawyers compelled some of the families, not all the families, 18 families, to sign documents that say that they accept the claim of ownership made by the settlers, and they agreed to be considered protected tenants, which means just pay rent to the settler organization. And the problem with that agreement is that those who signed it did not really recognize what it entailed, because they couldn't speak Hebrew, because they trusted the lawyer, and it turned out that they were tricked. And all of these sophistications and legal mishmash led us to where we are, or where we started off at the early 2000s, when efforts by Nahlat Shimon, which is the main settler organization, which is also government supported, to make it clear. So just it's not just one charitable organization, it left to its own devices. It's left us with the first displacements that took place in 2008 and 2009. We probably, many of us, remember the case of M. Kamil Kurd, whose husband has passed away during these months of threats, and who set up a tent to protest the evictions and displacement. We remember the family of Rifq Al Kurd, whose son built a house in 2000. He was prevented from living in that house because the Israeli court said that this extension of the house is illegal because he didn't receive a permit. Obviously, the vast majority of Palestinians in Jerusalem who apply for permits, their applications are turned down. So between 2000 and 2008, Nabil couldn't even enter the room he expanded and added to his home. His children had to watch this newly constructed room that they didn't even have the key to it. They couldn't even enter it. And suddenly, in 2008, 2009, when the Israeli settlers took over the house, they managed to enter this part of the home, and they managed for years since then to share this home, which Nabil built, which Nabil and his family spent their entire work, labor, and sweat in order to build this house. They had to contend with watching settlers, especially settler youth. It's very important to make it clear that the majority of those who live in Sheikh Jarrah as Israeli settlers, they're paradigmatic colonists. They're youth, they're armed to the teeth, they're very dangerous, they harass the citizens. So instead, in addition to living and sharing the breath that they, the air that these people breathe, they also harass them on a daily basis. And in addition to Al-Kurd family, also Al-Ghawi family also were displaced. And as he mentioned, the case of Shamasni, although he's not a refugee, but also he was one of those, he lived since the 60s in Sheikh Jarrah and who was displaced in 2017. So this is the basis of the case. I think Asil will talk more about the disparity and about how you live in two parallel worlds, in which on the one hand, you have Palestinians, internally displaced Palestinian refugees who have been displaced from their own land since 1948, including families, as I said, Rifq al-Kurd from Haifa, and families who came from Yafa, and families who are from Al-Baqa, which is in the western part of Jerusalem, and they can't go back to their homes, and they are not granted their right to return to their homes. And on the other hand, you have on fuzzy and on unproven proper ownership claims, you have Israelis who just the very fact that they claim that they've been that their land has been theirs since the 19th century, the Israeli law allows them to go, supposedly, to go back or to take over the land. And I think it's, Asil can talk about these, how you have this system, this legal segregation, this legal apartheid system in which one population based on ethnicity and religion have the right to go back to their homes and the other doesn't.
Thanks, Badour. Actually, Asil, I think that's actually a really good follow-on. We covered a lot of what I wanted to ask you. You know, the issue of law has come up over and over so far. And one of the things, I remember someone telling me this 25 years ago, when understanding Israeli rule in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, is the difference between rule of law and rule by law. And that in this context, Israeli law is used in order to implement what the Israeli policy is. It's, and that's not rule of law. To the extent that, I mean, what's always striking to me listening to both of you is thinking about the lengths that the Israeli government has gone to legalize illegal settler construction to the extent of literally suspending even the pretense of rule of law to say, fine, you took it illegally, it's privately ordered, we're still going to let you keep it because it's more humane, right? It's the argument that it's inhumane to ask settlers to leave, even if they built illegally, while the other hand is doing everything to dispossess and displace Palestinians, saying, sorry, it's the law, there's nothing we can do. So, you know, following up on what Badour said, and we've seen the Human Rights Report, which, you know, highlights the growing international recognition or normalization of the term apartheid when we're talking about this. Can you talk about that? Talk about how that framework applies or how it should be used to understand what we're seeing today in Sheikh Jarrah. And you know, this is an opportunity also if you want to talk a little bit, for instance, what's happening in Silwan, where there's a massive looming displacement happening. It's not just Sheikh Jarrah.
I think these are excellent questions to go into the broader context of what enables such evictions. And I would like to start by saying you mentioned apartheid, and indeed Israel is an apartheid regime, but I think also to clearly and specifically illustrate the Israeli regime as it is, apartheid is also a symptom of settler colonialism because Israel, when it was established in 1948, was established on the logic of the elimination of the Palestinian people and replacing it with Jewish settlers. So this is what the frame that captures what is the Israeli regime. Now, Israel, in order to enforce further dispossession after the Nakba or the 1948 war of the Palestinian people and to ensure that the Palestinians are not returned to their homes and that there are further displacement and dispossession, it enacted, as you said, a series of laws. Now, these laws, when we look at them, they cause injustice to the Palestinian people. And one such law that affects the people of Sheikh Jarrah, but many other Palestinians, is the 1950 so-called absentee property law, which states that Palestinian refugees and Palestinian internally displaced during the 1948 Nakba they are considered absentees, although under another set of laws, citizenship laws and entry laws, they are denied the right to return. I myself, I'm a descendant of a refugee from from the western part of Jerusalem, from one of the 500 displaced and demolished villages called Lifta. So I personally not only don't have the access to reclaim the property of my grandparents, but I also don't have access to even enter the city of Jerusalem because of other policies, including the annexation wall and the permit system. But basically, just to focus on this law allocates all the properties of the refugees eligible. They are eligible for confiscation by the state. And if you see the contradictory that also Badour highlighted, you have another set of laws that only allows Israeli Jews to so-called the so-called law law of return, which allows any Jew in the world to enter Israel and to be granted citizenship and nationality upon entry. Sometimes these Jews don't even, if you want to go case by case, they're not even Jewish in religion. But anyhow, these Jewish people from all over the world are allowed to enter Israel and to be allowed the Israeli nationality. Now, on the other hand, we have, for example, the 19, this is a very specific, a law specific to the cases of Sheikh Jarrah also, that has allowed the evictions going on right now. It's, it was passed in 1970, specifically to East Jerusalem, and it states that only Israeli Jews are allowed to pursue claims to property that they allege to have owned in East Jerusalem before the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948. And so pursuant to this law, these settler organizations have managed to secure land ownership, as you said, in Kerm el-Jauni area, and as Budur said, in Kerm el-Jauni area and Sheikh Jarrah, but also in other parts of Jerusalem, specifically in Batn al-Hawa in Silwan, in occupied East Jerusalem also. We have a plot of land that have been secured, transferred to a settler organization, Atarit Kohanim, in 2001 or two. And since then, the settler organization have also been filing eviction lawsuits against the families in Silwan and Batn al-Hawa. And also, now the struggle is very much similar, because the people of Silwan are also, most of them, 80% of them are refugees, if not from 1948, but from the 67 war. So we're talking about a double displacement and dispossession experienced by the Palestinian people. We're talking about a very psychologically and also financially exhausting struggle within these Israeli courts that are very discriminatory and are enforcing discriminatory laws that constitute the foundation of Israel's apartheid regime, because Israel is not only basing its displacement and dispossession on laws, but also it has been conducting various policies to ensure the maintenance of its apartheid regime, including the strategic fragmentation of the Palestinian people. Now we see Palestinians abroad, refugees and in exiles are denied the right to return as a first category. Palestinian in the Gaza Strip under a severe and harsh blockade for above 13 years now. Palestinians in the West Bank, in the occupied West Bank, facing a military rule, and also Palestinian in East Jerusalem as also an occupied territory, but facing another set of laws with the same goal, as I mentioned, including the policy, for example, of residency revocation, where they're not allowed they're considered they are awarded a permanent residency status, which is in many cases revoked under very broad criteria, including if they don't succeed in proving that the so-called center of their life is in the city of Jerusalem, then they are at threat of losing their residency status. In other cases, they are asked to swear allegiance for the occupying power because they are protesting or resisting the illegal policies of the Israeli occupation. And so many Palestinians, I think 14,000 Palestinians have lost their residency status because of this policy. The last category of this strategic fragmentation policy is Palestinian citizens of Israel, who are also facing discriminatory measures and policies by Israel, including forcible transfer, for example, in the Naqab area, but also another discriminatory allocation of services. And we're seeing this very explicitly and shamelessly in laws that state of the Israeli state that state that only Jewish people have the right to self-determination. And so this is the second method. But the third method, which is also very relevant to what we started, is how Israel suppresses Palestinians since its inception in 1948, any form of resistance, including to raise your Palestinian flag, is considered a criminal act. And this policy of suppression includes many acts, including the use of force. Yesterday, a Palestinian boy was killed in Nablus. He's, I think, 15 years old by Israeli occupying forces. This is not a unique incident. This is, unfortunately, an incident that Palestinians have to accept as the norm. The use of force, the arbitrary detention. Currently in Sheikh Jarrah, many Palestinians are being detained. And as Boudour said, we have seen in the protests, many Palestinians coming from inside the Green Line, from Haifa and so on, also in detention centers where for a preliminary monitoring by Al-Haq, we can say that there are beatings in these detention centers. Further investigation, like torture, is not something weird. Torture is another means by to suppress Palestinian resistance, and it's sanctioned by Israeli courts. I don't want to go along with this, but just to highlight that Israel uses all these different methods to suppress the Palestinian will to resist the illegal and ongoing settler colonial policies, and this proves a third an element of the crime of apartheid, which is the intention to maintain an apartheid regime.
You have been listening to Asil Al-Bajeh, Boudour Hassan, and Laura Friedman discussing the ongoing assault on the Palestinian neighborhood Sheikh Jarrah by Jewish settlers who are dispossessing them from their homes in violation of international law. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here every week at the same time and place on your radio dial. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org. All one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague and sound engineer, Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.